15 years ago, after much contentious debate, South Carolina came together in a bipartisan way to move the flag from atop the Capitol Dome. Today, we are here in a moment of unity in our state, without ill will, to say it's time to move the flag from the Capitol grounds.
That is South Carolina Governor Nimrutha Runthawa, better known as Nikki Haley, speaking at a press conference yesterday. She and Louisiana Governor Piyush, or Bobby, Jindal are rising Indian American stars of the Republican Party. Jindal is expected to announce his run for the Republican presidential nomination tomorrow. And there's a renewed focus on Nikki Haley and her racial identity in the aftermath of the killings of nine black worshipers in a historic Charleston church last week. Mitra Kalita is managing editor at the Los Angeles Times, and David Woodard is political science professor at Clemson University in South Carolina. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mitra, let me start with you. Lawmakers in South Carolina have been calling to remove the Confederate flag from the state house. At least some lawmakers have, but it looks like Nikki Haley might be the one to actually make it happen. Does her background allow her to make this move where maybe a white Southern politician wouldn't be as able to?
Indians, I think, have been able to straddle multiple identities. And in some ways, they're this microcosm, a representation of the complexity of racial identity in America. Indian Americans are the single most affluent immigrant group. And, you know, as you noted in your introduction, she and Bobby Jindal have ascended to governorships of two southern states, which is no small feat in states that remain majority white. Their features, you know, they look Indian, but their names are Nikki and Bobby. They're both Christian, church-going politicians. So I think that her ability to straddle both sides, if you will, you know, Indians being neither black nor white, certainly does give her the ability to kind of go out there and say, you know, this is a part of our past. As you said, we're looking towards our future, which for the Republican Party has been a phrase that they've used quite often as they're appealing and kind of trying to gain racial unity with an eye towards 2016 election.
Right. David Woodard, let me bring you in on this. I believe you actually did some work for Nikki Haley's opponent in her first race for governor. But could you talk more broadly about her appeal to Republicans in South Carolina?
She had a rough first election, but she was reelected against the person she beat the first time around pretty substantially. She doesn't have an outstanding legislative record, but she certainly seized her moment this past week.
Yeah, and so has that vaulted her to a larger national platform, do you think?
I certainly think it has. I think she sort of crystallized everybody's emotions immediately after the shooting and then in the days since. I certainly think that she's captured a lot of the spirit of South Carolina and also nationally. I think that's been very appealing.
And politically, how does she differ from Bobby Jindal?
She probably doesn't have the legislative accomplishments that Bobby Jindal does. He's really moves Louisiana forward. Most of her legislative accomplishments have come because the legislature has passed things over her veto. But people don't really care so much about that, I think, as much as the fact that she's been able to do well in this particular crisis. And in the past, South Carolina oftentimes has not done well on the national stage.
All right. I want to play a clip of tape for when she was running for governor back in 2010. Here is South Carolina State Senator Jake Knotts, who was opposing her.
Her daddy wears a turban around Lexington, and her mama wears a ruby between her head. And she is a sheik and trying to be a Methodist. We got a raghead in Washington. We don't need a raghead in the state house.
All right. Just to make clear, he was not her opponent in the election, but he was supporting her opponent. And so, Mitra, faced with an attitude like that, is it surprising that she would change her name from Nimrutha Runthawa to Nikki Haley?
I think that in the cases of Bobby Jindal and Nikki Haley, they've certainly had to prove their Americanness, not just to be accepted by voters, but quite frankly, to be accepted in the Republican Party. The clip that you played, I think, shows just how deep a lot of these sentiments are in the South and how different is something that both candidates have had to actually work to tout their similarity. So again, they go to church. Their names are sort of all-American names. They're giving voters something that they can grab onto to seem similar. I will say that a lot of Indians themselves, liberal Indians, have actually been very vocal critics of Nikki Haley. She's received some awards in New York, and there have been protests at them. So her move yesterday on the Confederate flag is very, very significant. I think you're absolutely right in saying, is this more of a national kind of stake on who the Republican Party wants to be and who they want to serve? And I think that was a real sign yesterday, because again, she's not even been able to take the Indian vote for granted.
Yeah. And so also some Indian Americans have protested Bobby Jindal as well for moving too far to the right, maybe assimilating a little bit too much. And David Woodard, I wonder if from a Republican national stage perspective, if that is something that these candidates have to do in order to become stars in the Republican Party these days?
Well, I think so. They have to tack to the right before a national race, but I don't think that's why she's doing it. She's doing it because she believes it. She had a business in her home for a while. She was an accounting major here at Clemson. I think she believes these things. It's not done for any crass political purpose.
She believes what things?
She believes the things about free markets and less government intrusion, no central planning, those kind of things. That's sort of part of her ideology.
Right. But how is she going to be able to be part of a new Republican Party that is trying to embrace minorities and to, rather than run away from an ethnic identification and embrace that for perhaps younger voters who want to see that?
Well, I think she'll just tell her story. She lived in suburban Columbia. She was accepted. She was accepted enthusiastically into the Republican Party. She ran. She was elected as a legislator enthusiastically. She was sort of held up as a model of sort of self-help, people who could be included. And then she went on to run for governor. She was behind in the governor's race very badly until she was endorsed by Sarah Palin and former First Lady Jenny Sanford. But once she got in office, she kind of stumbled out of the gate, as many first-time executives do. But after a while, she really got her sea legs under and began to do much better. And she's really riding a cloud right now.
And do you think she'll seek higher office?
Well, I don't know that she will. I mean, I think someone would have to seek it for her. I don't know what she would do after this. But, I mean, it depends on what happens in 2016. I think there may be some opportunities for her if the Republicans are able to win.
And Mitra, here in California, Kamala Harris is half Indian American. We had Neel Kashkari running for governor, who is Indian American. Neither one of them changed their name, as far as I know, and don't seem to be, you know, running necessarily away from their Indian American backgrounds. Is it a different thing when you're thinking about the South?
I think it is. I think that the coastal cities, the you know, places where the majority minority is not just the future, it's very much the present, but actually it's the difference that makes perhaps Latino voters, you know, see you as one of them, is really celebrated. And certainly we see that, you know, in New York City and Los Angeles and some other, I would say it's largely urban phenomenon. However, the Indians have been really good at being able to cling to the family values, patriotism. Again, the affluence that they've been able to achieve in the U.S. speaks to a work ethic. And I do think that both Nikki Haley and Bobby Jindal have been able to speak to this. You know, if you look at the Republican Party right now, which is the party that, you know, many would say has been supportive of the Confederate flag and has been accused of some race-based policies that perhaps are not the most favorable. Look at the names, though, that we're talking about. We're talking about Nikki Haley, Bobby Jindal, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio. I would say that slate, even if we're talking about them tangentially for 2016, sounds a lot more diverse than what you're seeing on the other side. And so this points to an issue that I don't think is a southern issue or a coastal state issue, but one where people of color, I think, are sick of being taken for granted by the Democratic Party. And perhaps this, you know, might be representative of the future that Nikki Haley is talking about.
Hmm. And in general, are Indian American voters largely Democratic or what?
They are. They've actually swung more Democratic. And one of the, and I'm not sure of the exact statistic, but Obama was a real game changer in Asian American voting patterns. A Pew Center study on this actually showed that his second largest voting bloc, so after, if you say the majority of African Americans voted for President Obama, it was very similar among Asian Americans, which they had never done before for another candidate. So there was something that happened about 7 years ago. You know, was that for the party? Was that for the candidate? Which is why I think, again, talking about a diverse slate of candidates, you know, makes sense that, again, they're not just, the Democrats cannot just take this voting bloc as a, you know, a racial identity voting bloc for granted.
Mitra Kalita, managing editor at the LA Times, and David Woodard, political science professor at Clemson University in South Carolina. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the show, we're going to continue this line, this conversation, but we're going to talk about the Latino vote. The president won 70% of the Latino vote back in 2012, but 2016, an entirely different year, an entirely different race. We're going to talk about why Hillary Clinton is worried about winning Hispanic voters next on Press Play.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you compare the field of Democratic and Republican presidential candidates, they are a lot different. The Democrats have a clear front runner. The Republicans have a dozen or so candidates fighting to distinguish themselves. One thing both parties have in common, though, is they are aggressively courting the Latino vote. According to the Pew Research Center, 25 million Latinos were eligible to vote in the midterms, and that number is expected to be even higher in 2016. So today we're going to focus on the Republicans with Ruben Navarrete. He's a nationally syndicated columnist and regular columnist for The Daily Beast and others. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Daniel Garza is here. He's an executive director of the Libre Initiative. That's a Latino outreach group funded in part by the Koch brothers. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Madeline.
Ruben, let's start with you. According to exit polls, President Obama won more than 70% of the Latino vote in the last election. So for Republicans, will this election be any different?
Well, you know, a lot of that has to do with how the presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton emerges from the primary process. And also, particularly with regards to her stance on immigration, which is sort of all over the map. And then also who they nominate. I've said before there could be about 15 Republican candidates before we're done vying for the presidency, 15, and only about three or four of them will be in play for Latinos. That means if the odds are against Republicans, if they nominate 11 out of the 15 or so, they have no shot at the Latino vote. But there are a few who could do some damage there. Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and possibly also someone like Chris Christie if he makes his way up into the top tier.
And not Ted Cruz?
Not in a million years. His last name doesn't help him. He's viewed as much more of a Republican first and a Latino second.
Daniel Garza, you are in Texas as well, correct? Why isn't Ted Cruz more a favorite amongst Latino voters?
Well, I think Ted has focused his efforts mostly on the primary voters, which tend to be non-Latino, mostly Anglo-Americans. And he speaks in a very conservative tone, to conservative ideas. Now, these have broad appeal to the Latino community as well. After all, 36% of Latinos self-identify as conservative. But I think at the same time, your political narrative has to be inclusive, has to speak to what are you going to do with the folks, that, you know, the 12 million that are here undocumented specifically, as opposed to evading the question. And I think you also need to tell your personal story, I think, directly to the Latino community. And sometimes that means tailoring your message directly to them. So the impression that he should leave is that not only am I inclusive in my political narrative, but in my policy solutions, I'm going to give the attention to the Latino community as well.
So which out of the candidates so far does speak to these issues, does talk about the 12 million undocumented people here in the United States?
Well, I think Jeb has a great narrative on that one. He's got a good track record as well. He has stood strong in that position. I think Marco Rubio has shown leadership. After all, he was the one who was going to introduce legislation for the Dreamers before he got short-circuited by Barack Obama's executive action. And he's the one who actually led the effort in the Senate side to pass immigration reform. So he's shown leadership on the issue, and I think that's very strong. I think also Rand Paul has been very comfortable in minority communities, outreaching. And Chris Christie, who got 51% of the Latino vote, predominantly Puerto Rican. That's a tough nut to crack in the Latino community.
Yeah. Ruben, going back to Chris Christie, he hasn't announced. He might not even be in the race. Why is he a contender in your mind?
Daniel's absolutely right about this. He did a fantastic job in his reelection campaign in New Jersey of getting north of 50% of the Hispanic vote. And the way he did that was he went out simply retail politics. You go out there and get it. He brought in Susana Martinez, who's a friend of his, a fellow governor from New Mexico who speaks beautiful Spanish. And they went out to places like Union City, New Jersey, which are heavily Hispanic. They did very well there. And when later on, when they asked Chris Christie, what was your secret? He said, it's simple. You know, you go out there, you ask people for their votes. And I think the Republican Party at its strongest goes out there and asks for the votes. At its weakest, it writes off those voters. And even there are times when, and we see this in the Republican field, they can't resist the catnip of going after a very ugly nativist language. You see it most recently with Donald Trump and others. And Daniel's right. If he's in the mix this time around, that'll be a factor.
Well, I also wonder, you just mentioned the things that Donald Trump and others have said as divisive and worse. Does that tarnish the entire brand of the GOP then?
Well, it certainly confuses the brand. It confuses it in the minds of people in the party, the candidates themselves, and the voters. So I think when you have some members of the Republican field bringing up the issue, it forces others to stake out a position. Well, I know what I want as a Latino. I want these Republicans running for president stand up loud and clear, point to Donald Trump and say, he doesn't speak for me. And if they don't have the guts to do that, they probably don't deserve that support. So it does get interesting, I think, when in both parties you have people pushing to various directions and they're forcing the frontrunners to come with them.
Okay. You mentioned speaking Spanish. So speaking of, let's hear Jeb Bush making his announcement recently, his announcement that he's in the race, and he did it partly in Spanish.
I intend to let everyone hear my message, including the many who can express their love of country in a different language. Ayúdenos en tener una campaña que les da la bienvenida. Trabajen con nosotros por los valores que compartimos y para un gran futuro que es nuestro para construir para nosotros y nuestros hijos. Júntense!
All right. He certainly sounds fluent, and by many accounts, he seems to connect with a lot of Latinos, and especially in Florida. His wife is Latino. He's a Latino campaign manager. Daniel, Jeb Bush, let's say he wins, a la Toni Morrison's comment on Bill Clinton, would he be the first Latino president?
I can tell you he'll have the first Latino family as a president. But look, he connects. There is a genuine affinity to the Latino community. And his Spanish is superb, by the way, and I can attest that actually
right.
He is very fluent. But, you know, at the end of the day, the Spanish is great, but it gives him an advantage, a window of opportunity to speak to the hearts and minds of Latinos. And that's speaking on immigration, on the American dream, on opportunity. Look, I think it's going to come down to economic freedom versus economic populism. And I think Jeb has the right message on this one. We are like every other American. We're looking for that leader that can inspire confidence, I think, in a renewed American leadership model. You know, promises made, promises kept kind of thing.
He does need to talk about immigration. They all need to talk about immigration, right?
Without a doubt. And look, this is an issue of the heart. This is where your narrative has to be inclusive. It has to speak to the folks who come here to work hard, who are industrious, who are seeking opportunity. And how you speak about them and allow them to be absorbed into our community and come out into the light, that impacts the Latino voter.
So, you know, I mean, there are lots of ways of saying that. There's ways of saying path to legalization. There's amnesty. There's full citizenship. I mean, there are many different ways of saying this. What do they need to say?
I think it's a framework. You know, you can speak to a path to citizenship, but at minimum, I think one has to offer up a work visa program, a legalization program that would include circularity, that one can, you know, freely come to and from a country that he pleases, a country of origin, that there be mobility of a job, that there be family unification, that you're not disadvantaged to get in line for citizenship, I think if you can include these kind of criteria or these qualifications into a work visa bill, you're going to have, I think, a welcoming position.
And Ruben, what do you think? I mean, if Jeb Bush said the right things when it comes to this issue, immigration?
He has, oftentimes to his peril within the Republican field. He once referred to the act of coming to the United States, even without documents to support your family, as an act of love. And right-wing talk radio went apoplectic. And all it's done for Jeb Bush is compel him to the top of the field. I find that interesting. People have said all along Jeb has cooked his goose with conservative voters, but every poll I've seen lately shows him at the top or near the top of the Republican field. And all the folks who've been demagoguing the issue are at the bottom. I will say that there is always a trap, though, because, again, the Republican Party does have this tendency to go back to this perception that there goes the neighborhood, that you're bringing in an inferior group of people who are dangerous, who commit crimes and the like. Trump said it outright, but that's not to say there aren't a lot of Republican voters out there who think exactly those same things. Daniel's right. A nice middle ground here is legal status without citizenship. That Latinos can get behind. You're not barring them from seeking citizenship, but they have to go the rest of the way on their own. I think that might be the sweet spot. Hopefully more candidates will find their way there.
Right. But he has got to win some primaries before he moves to the center, right, on this issue?
At the very beginning, you've got New Hampshire, Iowa, and South Carolina. Jeb Bush may not win any of those. I think it's a safe bet. He, in fact, won't win those three. But then comes Nevada. And when Nevada shows up, you've got 1 in 5 residents in Nevada are Hispanic. You'll have a strong Hispanic presence there. His rhetoric will play well there. Look for Jeb Bush to win Nevada and turn back the tide starting in Nevada.
Okay, Daniel, let's talk about Nevada and Hillary Clinton already on the ground there. She recently said at a rally there that when they talk about legal status, that is code for second-class status. So how do Republicans counter that perception that citizenship is not supported by the majority of the party? And can that damage the Republican nominee, whoever he or she is, in Nevada? And that's a crucial state to win in the general.
Look, I think Latinos have learned a very hard lesson, and that is that a politician can make all the promises in the world, but if you don't deliver, what good is the promise? So if Hillary Clinton is like Lucy with the football, you know, she's actually taken a more unrealistic position on executive action than Barack Obama, whose executive action is tied up in the courts, and I'm referring to DAPA, then what good is it for Hillary to make all those promises but not deliver? And I think that's what Latinos have to ask themselves.
But Nevada is also a strong union state, and a lot of Latinos are in labor unions in Nevada.
It is. But you know what's interesting is that Brian Sandoval actually received 70% of the vote and flipped the Senate and the House in Nevada with the Latino vote for the first time since the 1920s that has happened in Nevada. This is a state where it was only one of two states that actually the Latino vote went higher for Mitt Romney from the previous cycle. California being the other state. So there is a trend in Nevada that is actually favorable to Republicans, but they have to capitalize.
So, Matt, let me push back a little bit on Daniel on that point on Nevada, and here's why. Brian Sandoval is a great political story. I mean, what a phenomenal governor he's turned out to be. He's very high numbers across the board. Democrats like him as well. This is the same Brian Sandoval who said of Mitt Romney's self-deportation plan that it was nutty and didn't make sense. It's the same Brian Sandoval who came out in favor of comprehensive immigration reform. It's the same Brian Sandoval who said that recently that being conservative doesn't mean being hard-headed, and against government. And lastly, it's the same Brian Sandoval who just signed a bill to allow in Nevada undocumented young people to become teachers. So Brian Sandoval is by no means a typical Republican. If anything, he is a left-leaning Republican on the issue of immigration. And I think that, again, is a sweet spot.
I think Ruben is absolutely right that you have to show a different way and show a different model. But take a look at what happened in 2014 in Texas. 44% of Latinos voted for Greg Abbott, 51%
right.
for Cornyn,
right.
45% for Mark Udall in Colorado, 47% for Nathan Deal, and 42% for Sonny Perdue in Georgia, 47% for Sam Brownback, and 40% for Roberts for the Senate. So across the country, you're seeing a trend that was favorable to Republicans.
I wonder, though, Ruben, if Latinos are disillusioned by the fact that there hasn't really been comprehensive immigration reform that the president had wanted and hasn't been able to get through Congress, and whether that will dampen their enthusiasm when it comes time to vote.
Disillusioned is really a nice way of putting it. I mean, they are much wiser than they were 8 years ago. I'll just point out that recently, Cecilia Munoz, who is the president's right hand on Latino issues and head of the Domestic Policy Council, was booed and heckled at a meeting of immigration attorneys, precisely because so many people who are in the know and know immigration law know that this president and this administration has been horrible on issues of apprehension, detention, and deportation. And so I think that Latinos are not just disappointed. They've begun to figure out that they've been hustled and they've been conned. And as Daniel pointed out, the other side has figured out, Democrats have figured out, that if you promise the moon and stars, it'll never happen. You'll enrage the Republicans. They'll kill the bill. Then you get to fall back and say, oh, gee whiz, I tried my best. Give me all the credit and them all the blame. And it's a tried and true formula. It's worked out well. But I think Latinos are getting wise to that. And that's why I think they're not embracing Hillary Clinton.
But do you think that they might just not vote at all? Or do you think that this will actually push them into the arms of Republicans?
If the nominee is Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio, Hillary Clinton has a problem, a real problem.
But, you know, like I said at the outset, 70% went for the president in the last election. Do you really think that that could switch? That could actually flip?
The important part of politics comes in two pieces. One is, how good are you as a candidate? The other part of it is, how bad is your opponent? Yeah, Barack Obama got 70% against a candidate who could never relate to people, who actually was quoted on tape as saying 47% of Americans would never vote Republican because we're on the dole. Not everybody gets so lucky. You know, not everybody wins the dumb Republican lottery. Sometimes you catch a smart Republican. And if you run against Jeb Bush, you're in trouble.
All right. I want to thank you both very much. Ruben Navarrete, nationally syndicated columnist, and Daniel Garza, executive director of the Libre Initiative. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And we would love to hear from you, especially if you are Latino. What do you think of the candidates so far? Are they saying what you want to hear? And if not, what do they need to do to get your vote? You can leave us a voicemail and we may play it at the end of today's show. 1-844-PRESSPLAY or Twitter at KCRW PressPlay. Coming up, we have your summer reading list. Yes, we do. Fiction and nonfiction with the editor of the New York Times Book Review. That's after a news update with Steve Chiotakis.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Summer officially began this week. So with all that extra daylight, why not stay inside and read a book? We're going to talk about new summer books with Pamela Paul, editor of the New York Times Book Review. Hi, Pamela. Welcome back.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's start with fiction and one book that's been getting tons and tons of press, and that's Judy Blume's In the Unlikely Event. This is for adults.
It is. It's her first adult novel in years. It's a story that actually stems from her own childhood. There was an event that took place. She grew up in New Jersey, and there were three plane crashes in her town in the course of one summer. And she uses that as a kind of jumping off point for this novel, which I think is, you know, in many ways, a coming of age novel. So it's not strange territory for Judy Blume.
So it's nothing like Wifey, in other words.
No, this is not one that I think teenagers will be swiping off their parents' shelves.
But do you think that it is something that adults will take to and they'll want to bring with them on their summer vacations?
I think, you know, it already is. It's already hit our bestseller list here at the New York Times. I think, you know, a lot of Judy Blume fans are now in this grown-up reading territory. So I think they're sort of primed readers.
Okay, great. You've also brought along a couple of books dealing with race.
Race is a big theme, not surprisingly, in fiction and in nonfiction, mirroring what's going on in the country. There have been a number of books that sort of take a satirical look at race that have come out late this spring and into summer. First, there was The Sellout by Paul Beattie. The latest one is Matt Johnson's Loving Day, in which there's a daughter of a mixed-race character. He refers to himself as a mulatto. There's a lot of sort of impolitic terms thrown around, but his daughter is white. So that is an interesting kind of parallel to what's been going on in the news with Rachel Dozial, and another book, Mislaid by Nell Zink, similarly deals with those themes. So it's kind of an odd way in which fiction is reflecting what's going on in the news.
Right. And Loving Day referring to the Supreme Court decision, Loving v. Virginia?
Yes, yes. So it's a kind of mashup of a novel. There's a ghost story in it. It's about Philadelphia. It's about parenthood. It's about race. So it's a complicated, interesting novel. And it was reviewed very favorably on our cover by Baz Dreisinger.
All right. Another interesting one that's getting a fair amount of coverage in your pages, I think, as well as in other pages, The Meursault Investigation. And this is a debut novel by Algerian journalist Kamel Daoud. I hope I pronounced his name right.
Yes, you did. Yes, that was another cover review for us. Unusually, a novel in translation. We don't have books in translation very often on our cover. And what's interesting about this book is it takes as its jumping off point Albert Camus' novel, The Stranger, in which Meursault, the title character of that book, kills a nameless Arab and just leaves him there. And this novel gives that Arab a name, turns him into the lead character of his book, and the murder of the stranger is an actual crime that takes place. What's happened to Kamel Daoud in real life is also quite interesting in that he does live in Algeria. He continues to live there, even though this novel has brought similar threats that Salman Rushdie had brought against him. So he's been criticized in Algeria for having written this novel.
Oh, really? So it's seen as anti-Islam?
Yes, yes.
Interesting. This reminds me of Jean Rhys's book, Wide Sargasso Sea, when she takes Jane Eyre and tells it from the perspective of the madwoman in the attic.
There are so many books that have been using English literature as a jumping off point this spring, too. And going into the summer, there's Read Jane, which by Patricia Park. There's this ongoing series that takes Jane Austen's novel. The latest one is by Andrew McCall Smith, doing a modern up sort of take on Emma. So that's definitely been a current in the last year or two.
Okay, and there's also a new book from the novelist Vendela Vida. Tell us about that one.
That's another North African tale. Very interesting short novel, The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty. The book takes place in Casablanca and very much a point of departure for Vendela Vida. I mean, she always does these books about women going abroad and kind of getting into trouble in various ways. This is a book about identity, and what she does that's different in this book is uses the second person. So it's told in that, you know, you get off the plane and you find that your bags have been stolen. And that's what happens to her. It's a woman, she gets to Casablanca, and as she's checking into her hotel, she finds that her passport, all of her money, all of her identification, her suitcases are gone.
That sounds really exciting.
Yes, it's very filmic. And she then, this nameless person who is you in the novel, goes on to take on a number of different identities, including a stand-in for a famous actress on location in Casablanca.
Okay, so that segues into perhaps a discussion about thrillers, because we seem to want to read thrillers in the summertime. And do you have any good ones?
Summer is such a great time for thrillers. And there are a few that sound really great. The Fixer by Joseph Finder is one new one, in which a journalist who is not surprisingly out of work in terms of newspapers now writes puff pieces for a local magazine, but gets laid off. And the premise is that after he's laid off, he's taking care of his parents, another major theme in both fiction and nonfiction and real life lately. And he discovers $3 million in cash in the building's crawl space of his father's old house. And sort of that's the jumping off point. And it's funny because there's another novel, another thriller that is also about a writer that's getting a lot of attention that looks great, called The Truth and Other Lies by Sasha Arango. And actually, Joseph Finder reviewed it for us, gave it a very strong review. And this is about a best-selling novelist. It's written actually by a German screenwriter. screenwriter. He's a best-selling novelist whose secret is that he doesn't actually write his novels. His wife does. And then, yes. And then there's all kinds of, you know, lies and truths and a mistress and thrilling things ensue.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. All right. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Pamela Paul. She's the editor of the New York Times Book Review. Let's get to nonfiction. There are two Nixon books out. Why two?
Well, you know, it's funny. There are just often these coincidences. The two books are One Man Against the World, The Tragedy of Richard Nixon by Tim Weiner. That book actually was originally going to come out at the end of July, but because a new book called Being Nixon, Man Divided by Evan Thomas was coming out in June, they rushed the pub date up of the Weiner, and the two of them both came out last week. Here's the sort of shorthand difference between the two. One Man Against the World, the Tim Weiner, is very much a look at, you know, just how terrible Nixon was as a president. That there's a clear opinion that comes through in this review. And that follows a period in which Nixon had kind of been rehabilitated. People had looked back and said, well, maybe he wasn't so bad. You know, he did all of these things for the environment. He wasn't terrible in a number of social policies. So this one is saying, no, actually, he was so bad. Being Nixon, A Man Divided by Evan Thomas, is a little bit more even-handed. So those are two one-volume books about Nixon. For those who like books on dark subjects in summertime, and I count myself among those, there's actually a number of kind of serious nonfiction books on the horizon.
There is one called Stalin's Daughter, which sounds...
That is indeed dark.
Dark, very dark.
yes, that's by Rosemary Sullivan. The subtitle is The Extraordinary and Tumultuous Life of Svetlana Allilueva. And she, I mean, this is actually a massive biography. And it seems deservedly so, because she really led quite a life. And I will just throw out one. She was married three times. She died penniless in Wisconsin. So you wonder
Wisconsin,
how she got.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And there are many, many steps, places in between where she lived and had her ups and downs. And it really, it's a thorough biography. It's the first real biography of Svetlana Allilueva.
That sounds fascinating. It also sounds like a thriller, because it seems like all things Russian mean thriller, at least in my mind.
And ends in a downfall.
Yes, exactly. And what about this book, Do No Harm, by Henry Marsh?
You know, there have been a lot of great books recently by doctors. Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, is, I think, still on our bestseller list at number 9. And he follows, of course, in the footsteps of other really incredible doctor writers. The ones that spring to mind are the book Emperor of All Maladies. And this latest one, Henry Marsh's Do No Harm, is a memoir by a British surgeon. Some of it is specific to the British healthcare system, but even that is very interesting, I think, for American readers to see the differences in how the UK handles healthcare versus the way we do. But what's interesting about Marsh's book is he really talks about some of the difficulties of brain surgery and just how little we know, how much we know, and how little we know at the same time. And that, too, has become a bestseller.
And finally, appropriately, there is a book about air travel, and it actually makes you want to get on a plane.
Yes, this is Skyfaring by Mark Van Honecker, a rare positive view at air travel these days. But Van Honecker is a pilot, and so he has a different perspective from most of us beleaguered passengers, especially those of us with the riffraff in coach. But what he writes about isn't all of the, you know, hassle of contemporary air travel. He's not writing about terrorism threats or about the TSA. He's writing about the beauty of flight and just a reminder of how incredible it is that, you know, here we are floating through the sky in a metal box, and what that experience is like. And his writing is very lyrical, very beautifully done. So that's Skyfaring by Mark Van Honecker, something happy to think about when you're squished in you know, chair 36B.
Right, in the middle seat, just praying that you'll get there in one piece. Pamela Paul, editor of the New York Times Book Review, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Well, if you didn't get all those, we have a list on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney is here now for a preview into the summer edition of To the Point, at least today's
planning, of course, to read as many of those books as I can possibly get done. In 1890, the U.S. Supreme Court observed that solitary confinement would drive people to madness. Recently, Justice Kennedy took note of the fact that a 22-year-old person in New York had killed himself after being released, having spent 800 days in solitary confinement for a crime for which he was never charged, let alone being tried. 88,000 people, roughly, are now in solitary confinement in one or another of the justice systems, so-called, around the country. And there seems to be a movement to do something about that. Even conservatives are getting on board, even people who have come to realize that throwing away the key is not working. It's, in fact, counterproductive. And so we're going to talk about solitary confinement with a lot of different people, get some very interesting perspectives about it.
And are juveniles still locked up in solitary?
They are indeed. The 22-year-old was, in fact, a juvenile when he was originally locked up. And that's a major issue to be discussed, and we'll have somebody who will raise that question and tell us about how often it's done and why it's done.
Well, punitive, not rehabilitative.
Often punitive, often for allegedly for protection of the inmate, right, him or herself, and also to protect other inmates in the event that people get out of control.
Warren Olney, and To the Point, coming up at 1 o'clock in about 10 minutes from now. Thank you very much.
Indeed.
And before that, coming up on this show, a summer treat that is found only at Disneyland. Our food expert is here to talk about it and what's in it. Next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It is summer, so peak season for Disneyland, which means it's also peak season for the theme park's strange signature frozen dessert, Dole Whip. Dole Whip resembles pineapple-flavored soft-serve ice cream, and it's one of the most popular snacks at Disneyland. It has really a cult-like following, and it's the product of a long partnership between Disney and Dole, the world's largest fruit and vegetable producer. Catherine Spires is food editor at KCT. She's here now to tell us more about the strange history of Dole Whip. Hi.
Hi there.
So it's not Dole and Cool Whip. It's just...
It actually isn't, which for the longest time I thought it was. But no, it's just the name that they gave their special treat that was invented specifically for Disney.
What's in that special treat?
Well, the good news is that it's vegan. The bad news is it's vegan because it is powder and water.
Oh.
And I feel like a million people out
really?
There just went, oh, yeah, yeah, which is actually the basis of most soft serve that you can get anywhere.
What's in the powder?
Flavoring agents, emulsifiers, preservatives. But hey, it tastes really good, and that's what we're here to talk about, right?
Well, yeah, I guess. Well, when it was first invented, was it always powder?
I believe that it was. Part of the reason I believe it was because Dole wouldn't talk to me about this at all. They wouldn't give me any background about what Dole Whip was. So it says to me, I'm not sure that they ever had pineapple in it. However, they have a long and happy partnership with Disney, and they also sell pineapple juice and pineapple spears in the Disney parks. So they are giving them some real fruit.
How did this partnership come about?
So there's the Enchanted Tiki Room at Disneyland, and that was a passion project of Walt Disney's. And United Airlines was the first sponsor of that. But then in the 70s, United went away and Dole came in. They saw this as the perfect opportunity, being from Hawaii, it being a tiki room, for them to join forces at Disney. And they actually didn't invent Dole Whip right then in the 70s. It didn't come along until the 80s when the partnership had already had a long history.
And so some genius came up with this idea.
Yes, and it was
a
somebody did, who
not
I hope
a cook,
got a raise.
Obviously.
Right. And it was an excellent idea. Some people say, I mean, this sounds hard to believe, but some people say that Disneyland and Disney World sell 50,000 Dole Whips a month.
Really?
Yes. And I almost wouldn't believe it, except for that the amount of passion. If you Google Dole Whip, there's message boards dedicated to it. Multiple message boards from around the world. People love Dole Whip.
What is the attraction? I have to confess, I've never had it. I've never tasted it.
It does taste really good. So there's that. Also, for the longest time, you could only get it at Disney resorts. So it had this sort of, you know, special treat allure once a year whenever you're going there. That's not really so much the case anymore, because anyone can buy the powder. You can buy it for home use, but you have to buy it by like the 25-gallon jug or something like that. Gosh. But locally, you can actually get it at Menchie's now too, the frozen yogurt chain.
Oh.
But there's people who will tell you that it tastes best at Disneyland, and there's some hacks for it as well. Like a lot of people who are regulars at Disneyland, they go across the walkway from the Dole Whip stand to the Tropical Import store.
Mm-hmm.
And there you can get a spice packet. It's called a Tajin or Tajin spice packet, and they'll actually sprinkle it atop their Dole Whip for a new taste sensation. It's kind of like, you know, the fruit stands around LA where you can get spices on fruit.
Right.
It's sort of that kind of idea.
Uh-huh.
So, and it's also the Tiki Room. The Enchanted Tiki Room is the one of the only attractions in Disneyland where you can bring food in. And you can bring any food, but it's also a great excuse to just, like, sit down in the dark with your frozen confection and take a little break.
Frozen Dole Whip. So it also fits because the Tiki Room was originally supposed to be a restaurant, right?
Yes. Walt Disney famously loved all things tiki. And so when he had the idea for the Enchanted Tiki Room, he envisioned it as a sort of supper club, dinner and a show type idea. And so they put in all the singing animatronic birds. And that was meant to be watched while you ate. But they decided that for financial reasons, that wasn't going to make sense to have people sitting there in one place for that long. So they took out the dinner component, and it's just the show with a little snack now.
And then there's this rivalry between East Coast and West Coast fans.
Oh, as with all things. Yes, absolutely.
It's not just rap. It's right? Also Dole Whip.
Yes, it is. And it's vicious, too. So some people say that Dole Whip tastes better at Disney World. Some people say at Disneyland. I don't think that there's any difference between the two. It probably just depends on which park you prefer. Where are you most happy? That's where you're going to like Dole Whip better.
I'm surprised that people haven't made their own versions of it with like real fruit and real cream.
Yeah, I am too. And I'm sure some people have, but it's not anything that's hit it big, because mixing powder and water together is pretty easy and it tastes good. So why mess with it?
It is pretty easy. I'll give you that. All right. Catherine Spires, food editor at KCT. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the tiki, 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 tiki room. In the tiki, 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 tiki room. All the birds sing words and the flowers croon. In the tiki, 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 tiki room.
Real music from the Tiki Room at Disneyland. Hi there.
I have never been.
You haven't?
But I feel like I'm there right now. I wish I had Dole Whip in front of me. Do they have any other flavors of Dole Whip, or is it just pineapple?
No, it's just pineapple, apparently.
That seems like
I've
a missed opportunity, as far as
but
I'm concerned.
But I have had Tang, so that...
Is it somewhat similar?
Well, it's powder.
Reminds me of astronauts.
And water.
I bet Dole Whip would go over well on the space station. So today, we did something of a politics blowout on the show today. Latino voters. We asked our Latino listeners what they wanted to hear from the candidates running for president. Amanda Leon tweets that she, like voters of any color, wants to hear how a candidate would create more jobs, more access to education, and a fairer tax system. She went on to say, though, that she wants to hear about changes to the drug policy that will help alleviate violence in Mexico. And since most Latino voters are middle and working class, she wants to know how the candidates would help make home ownership more affordable. It's a pretty comprehensive answer. James Lovano tweets that Latinos are not a monolith. He says that Mexican Americans will be hard pressed to vote for Cuban Americans. Cubans have had an easier go of it in America when it comes to immigration, is what James says. And there's just too big of a gap there.
Hmm.
So he thinks Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio are going to run into trouble with other Latino voters. So we also talked about summer books today, something close to my heart. And I just wanted to co-sign The Sellout by Paul Beatty and Mislaid by Nels Inc, two of my favorite books of the year. As Press Play's somewhat unofficial book editor, I say yes, 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 yes.
You can be
Beach
official.
Beach reads both.
You're now
intellectual.
Official.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I named myself. We can
yep.
do that now? Okay.
Why
I'm
not?
Also the president of Dole Whip. Bam.
All right. Jillie Myers, ruler of all of the universe. There she is. And you can tweet us what you want at KCRW Press Play. Any questions, any comments, we welcome them. Warren Olney is up next, the king of the universe at 1 o'clock. So keep it right here. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.